This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. It's time for another Bits and Pieces episode. We have a great lineup for you, including more interviews by Micah from the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In, Hillel's interviews with Crew Dog Electronics and Sky Vector at Air Venture Oshkosh, Launchpad Merzari reports on his visit to the Titan Missile Museum. He also tells us about his favorite flight. Micah provides his observations from this year's Innovations in Flight event at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And Brian tells us about the Friendly Skies exhibit at Peekaboo Gallery. On his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks with pilot Neil McCarthy about a 737 simulator project, and we talk with a 14-year-old student pilot from Australia. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 519 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. As is our tradition, when a U.S. holiday falls on Monday, when we normally record, we take the week off. Well, except we gather up pre-recorded segments from the co-hosts, the contributors, and you, our listeners, and create what we call a Bits and Pieces episode. That's the case this time, as we spend the Labor Day holiday with our friends and families. We have quite a lot for you, so let's get started. Our main man, Micah, has more interviews from this year's Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In. First, Bunk Chase.
Your main man, Micah, here with the Airplane Geeks, and I'm talking with Bunk Chase, and you are the president or founder of the EAA Chapter 144?
I am neither the president nor the founder, but I used to be president. Our president now is Ron Meyer, and we have lots of other guys, vice presidents and secretaries and treasurers, that do a lot of work to make all this happen.
Tell me a little bit about the chapter and how long it's been in existence, and how many people are members?
Our chapter 141 has been in existence since 1963, is when it was started. I can't remember all the members' names. I have them in a book at home, but they started actually in Sanford, Maine.
And how did you find it, and how long have you been flying?
I've been flying since early 70s, and I've lived in Leamington at 63 Bravo, Leamington Airport, since 1980. I bought a piece of land from Stan Harmon, the original founder of the airport, and built my house there and had a deeded easement to the airport runway and so forth. And my kids grew up there. My son became a pilot, and he's now an airline pilot. And my wife became a pilot when my son became a flight instructor. So we're a fly-in family, let me tell you.
That's great, a regular fly-in family. And tell us a little bit about the pancake fly-in. It's been going on for 20 years here at Spurwink Farm?
Actually, on our posters, we say 22 years. But it's actually been longer than that. Back in the very early 90s, Finney Sprague owns this place, was always an EA Chapter 141 member from the very beginning. So he called me up one day and asked if I would get a bunch of pilots together and come fly in to his airport here for his birthday party. Well, actually, his wife Mary Lou did it for him. So we all flew down here, all five of us. And we had a great time. And we made some pancakes, and we sold coffee and so on and so forth, and went back home with $50 or $75 profit. And we just kept saying, boy, isn't this wonderful? Look at the money we made, you know, and had so much fun. And that was pretty much the end of it. So we never said, geez, wouldn't it be nice to do that again or anything. But the next year, at the same time in July, Finney called me up personally at the airport, and he said, geez, you know, could you guys come down again this year? That was so much fun last year. So we did it again. And then on the third year that he invited us, we never did expect it really, but he invited us again, and we came down, and after that we started counting. So we're at least 24, 25 years into this.
Now, We were just talking with Sean Moody and talking about how the numbers have improved. You started with four or five people, and today I'm counting, we got to have at least, 300 people here today? How have the numbers been growing?
Last year, we estimated about 500 based on the breakfast that we sold. So 500 last year, it's going to be much bigger this year. I've had more calls and emails about this year than any previous year.
That's great. How do you account for the growth? Where do you think it's coming from? Do we have more?
Partly the economy. And, you know, EAA National has done all sorts of things to promote aviation in the last 50 years or so. And then in 25 years ago, they started this Young Eagles program. Do you know anything about that? Have you heard about the Young Eagles?
Tell us a little bit about the Young Eagles.
Well, Young Eagles started in 1992, actually, for a slow start by a bunch of guys at a chapter in California. And they wanted to find a way to get more people, young people, interested in aviation because all the Vietnam pilots were retiring and, of course, all the World War II guys were dying off and everything else, and there just weren't enough pilots for the airline growth. So they came up with this idea of flying young kids, pre-flights, give them free flights, and to promote aviation, and they called it the Young Eagle Program. So the next year, 93, they all got together and said, you know, this has been a pretty successful year. We've flown a few hundred young eagle in the last year, but that's really not enough. So why don't we set a goal? And the goal I'd like to set, and I can't remember the person's name out there that ran that chapter, is by December 17th, 2003, I'd like to fly 1 million young eagles. And the reason that he chose December 17th, 2003, it was the 100th anniversary of the first powered flight by Wilbur and Orville. And on December 17th, 2003, we flew 1.2 million.
That's wonderful. That's great.
It's a success story, isn't it?
It sure is. Now, tell us, Chapter 141, other than these wonderful breakfasts that you do and fly-ins, what else happens during the year? And do you offer a Young Eagles program? How Absolutely. Can people get in touch with you?
Absolutely. You can call me, Bunk Chase. You can look me up at EA.org, or you can call our present president, Ron Meyer. You can find his number the same way. Either Google up Chapter 141 or go to National EAA.org and log on to Chapter 141. And we have one Young Eagles Day. This is an exclusive Young Eagle Day in the summertime. We have a big pancake, a thing similar to this, but not really as big. And we give the kids all free soda, chips, and their parents too, you know, coffee and donuts and that whole thing. And we have a great fly-in up there. But those of us who have airplanes, we will fly a young eagle any day. Some guy comes out, wants a young eagle ride, we'll sign him right on the spot.
That's how we have to do it, to encourage our young folks to learn about aviation and to fly. Bunk, thank you so much. You're a busy man today. Well, you're a busy man every day, but particularly busy today.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with the Airplane Geeks, and hopefully we'll be able to get together again soon.
It is genuinely my pleasure.
Now Micah speaks with Dave DeVries.
And we're talking today with Dave DeVries, who flew in, and I think what's probably the oldest aircraft that came today. It's a 1935 Kinner Sportwing. And Dave, tell us a little bit about this airplane and how you found it.
I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, visiting a friend, and he took me over to an airport, which we always go, and we flew around in his fleet, his old 19-whatever fleet. And on the way back to the car, he says, I have something to show you. And we went by this rickety old wooden hangar, and he pulled the door open about, maybe 6 inches is all far it would go with a chain on it, and that's all we could see in there. And he said, look in there. And I looked in, and here sat this plane, all covered with bird doo-doo and dust, and been sitting there for a long, long time. And he explained it was the only one left in the world, a Sportwing. So this Kenner Sportwing, the only one left in the world. There are a few other Kenners, but the only Kenner Sportwing. So I saw it, and it was just beautiful. And so I saw it come up on, I'm trying to think of how this happened. I contacted a guy that owned it, and because it wasn't flying, I made him an offer. And he refused my offer. And so every now and then I would Google the N number, and I finally saw it on Trader Plane, and I called him. And I said, I'd like to renew my offer. And he says, no, I don't think so. So this went on for almost 15 years. And then I was, contacting him. So then I saw it in Trader Plane again. He put it back on. And I contacted him yet again. And he said he wasn't going to sell it for what I wanted to pay. But he said, I am taking it to Sun and Fun. And I think I can sell it there for what I want. So he took this plane, took the wings off. They were on a flatbed trailer. All the parts and pieces were there, but they were stuffed on this trailer. And he drove with his wife, pulling this thing all the way from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Sun and Fun in Florida. And so when I got to Sun and Fun, I didn't find him. So on the last day, I was there for 2 days, and I was ready to leave. I said, I got a couple hours before I got to head for Tampa, the airplane. So I wandered over to another area, and what did I see but this thing sitting there on the trailer with a for sale sign. So I wandered over again. And once again, I told him I renewed my offer. And he said, there's a lot of people looking at this. I'm sure I'm going to sell it. And I said, well, okay, but my offer is still good. So I went home, the airplane. My wife was elated because I came home without buying another airplane. So everybody was where we were. And then the next morning, I get a call from the guy. He said, I talked with my wife, and we've decided to accept your offer, and we've left the show. We're on our way to Boston. So they trailered this. They got there Monday to Boston, to Lawrence Airport, where I keep it, and unloaded it. And I was able to scramble on Monday and go get a certified check for him. So we put it in a hangar, and it was finally mine.
Now, when was that? What year are we talking about?
3 years ago, and at Sun and Fun, 3 years ago, April-ish time frame. So we came into Boston at Lawrence Airport and stayed there a short time. And then I had some people come up from the Philadelphia area, restoration company, came up, and they came back eventually and got it and took it back to Pennsylvania, and they restored it. Took them about 15, 16 months, and I picked it up last September. And, of course, I flew it back from first time in this thing. It was interesting. I flew it back from Pennsylvania in about three and a half hours. And then I flew it a few more times, but then winter got here, and you don't fly an open cockpit plane in the wintertime, so I didn't fly it much that year, so I got it out this year in May and started flying it. So, and this is really the first fly-in I've taken it to, Spurwing. So,
I'm so glad you're here, and it just made a scene when it came in, because as I took a couple of pictures and hope we'll post them on the website, it's absolutely beautiful. It looks like she's incredibly fun to fly. Is she? What's it like to handle her?
It's different. It's my first experience with an open cockpit airplane with a big radial engine out in front of it, but it jumps off the runway. Its visibility is terrible out at the brakes. I tell the people the brakes are more a suggestion than a brake. So it's hard to taxi. It's difficult to keep it going in the right direction. So it's a handful, but I'm getting more and more used to it, and we're becoming friendly. And it'll take a while, but by the end of the summer, I'll be in charge, and it'll be doing what I hope it'll be doing what I want it to.
So how long have you been flying, and how did you be? This is EAA, and we're trying to get people to become a part of it. How did you get involved with EAA, and how long have you been flying?
I got my license in 1971, and I was dating Sally. And we didn't have any money. So for dates, I would study for my flight, school, and she would, ask the questions, and I would do the answers, and that was how we dated. And I got my license back in 71, and I married Sally. She was a good instructor. So I married her, and I've been flying ever since. And fortunately, I've been able to own a lot of planes and do a lot of flying over the years. So...
So what else have you owned or do you own, and what's your favorite to fly?
Somebody said one time the favorite airplane I have is the one I'm flying that day, and I think that's true. I've got this, of course. I've got a Widgeon, a Grumman Widgeon. I got a Swift, a Globe Swift, a 1946 Swift. I've got a 1938 Stinson Reliant. I've got a Super Cub on floats. I got a 1946 Funk, and I got a Bonanza for going places. So that's quite a collection.
That's an amazing collection. How do you manage to be able to feel current in all of them?
I do fly them all. It's kind of crazy going from one of these to the other. But I do fly them all, and I try to get each one of them out every couple weeks at least and fly it somewhere, a breakfast run or a lunch run, or sometimes just I fly out to the coast and back. But I am able to exercise all of them every couple weeks.
Dave, I'm going to ask you one last question that I'm stealing from friends of ours across the pond from the Plane Talking UK podcast, and it's a question that they ask every pilot that they interview, and I want to ask it of you because you're very experienced with a lot of different aircraft. If you could fly any aircraft at all, past, present, retired, non-existent, what airplane would you want to get some hours in?
P-51.
P-51 Mustang. That's a great choice and one chosen by a lot of people. Yeah. They're beautiful, aren't they?
That's it. Well, that would be the one for me, I think. I'm at an age now where I'm not going to get in something like that and try to fly it. I'm having a hard enough time with these things. You should come down and visit the hangar sometime and see this collection and do something from there sometime.
We'd love to do that. Dave, thank you so much for talking with the Airplane Geeks, and we look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Okay, anytime. Thank you.
Okay, in a bit we'll bring you the final two interviews from Spurwink. But first we have Hillel in the hangar at AirVenture Oshkosh 2018, where he spoke with the founder of CrewDog Electronics, maker of the Stratus ADS-B receiver.
Hello, this is Hillel in the hangar. I'm at AirVenture 2018 in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, of course. And with me I have Sean Chupless, founder of CrewDog Electronics. So let me just start out by asking Sean, what is he doing here?
Thanks for having me. This is my first year at Oshkosh, so I'm here primarily to see the air show and get exposure to more general aviation and also support the year of the tanker since I was a KC-10 pilot, but also here in a bit of a professional capacity selling a Stratus ADS-B receiver, which I'm selling on Amazon and currently in person as well.
So you mentioned that it's a Stratus ADS-B receiver. Is that your first product?
Yes, this is my first product in aviation. I'm actually sort of a serial entrepreneur. I've had businesses before in real estate, part owner of a gym, energy drink company. Background is a bit in computer science, got my MBA, just graduated from Naval War College. This is my first venture into selling products in the general aviation world. Extensive background in the military and also CFI work, so I'm really excited to be involved with the business. It lets me get connected to flying again.
I can totally relate to that. So why did you decide to do this particular product?
So a little bit about my background. Like I said, I flew the KC-10, went on to get out of the military. I fly for a major airline as well. But the interesting theme I saw, even though I was flying some of the more advanced aircraft in the world, avionics hadn't really caught up yet. I was doing some CFI instruction in Hawaii, and because you're in Hawaii, there's islands, not a lot of places to land. Having live weather and traffic was something that was very important to make me feel safe flying in Hawaii. So I went out there and I saw that there weren't a lot of options for ADS-B that were affordable. So a CFI friend of mine turned me onto the Stratus project and said, hey, there's an ADS-B receiver that you can assemble yourself and get it for a price point that's not $1,000. So I went and assembled one myself, went through and did a lot of testing, and after I finally got one working, a few friends of mine in the squadron said, hey, can you build one for me? So after that, ended up starting a business of my own, started just building these in my kitchen, selling them on Amazon, and it sort of took off. But really, the fundamental reason why I started doing this is I believe ADS-B technology, this is something that's ADS-B towers are funded by the FAA. These are our tax dollars. I think it helps everybody fly safer. So I wanted to make this technology available for everybody, and I want to put it out there at a price point that everybody could afford.
Those are all great reasons. How long have you been at it?
I've been in business for about a year. The beginning of the business was sort of slow, but it's really exploded. Actually, if you type in ADS-B on Amazon, my product is the one that pops up. I'm the top-selling ADS-B receiver on Amazon, 5-star reviews, 150 reviews last time I checked. So it's been quite a journey. It's really picked up steam. I spent this past year getting another graduate degree with the Navy at Naval War College. So it's been a bit of a challenge to juggle this business and graduate school at the same time. But I'm excited now to be done with that, focus getting more back to flying and growing this business and expanding a little bit more, not just in the U.S. I've actually got customers around the world. I've had customers in Germany, U.K. Some people actually stopped by here at Oshkosh, they're in Australia, tested it out, and worked with their EFB software that they use in Australia as well.
That's great. So you said you were doing CFI stuff in Hawaii, and there was a clear need for that. Do you see other needs, or you're interested in other product ideas, or that's still too soon, or what's going on?
I've mainly been focusing on this because this, like I said, this really exploded more than I thought it would. In the beginning, I was doing all the manufacturing, just kind of building these by myself, but quickly got to a point where I had to get teams for manufacturing and help people with people to help me with production. I'm looking at some other products that I think are beneficial for aviation, such as like LED lighting. A partner of mine is looking at noise reduction headsets. So I think there's a lot of things that exist in aviation that help us fly safer, should be there at affordable price. But for right now, I'm focusing on this ADS-B business, want to grow it out a little bit more on Amazon, expand overseas if I can, and then I'll see what's coming up next after that.
Super. Now, for some people who may be listening may not actually know exactly why this project existed, I guess in a Reddit project, and what it was there to do, or what was the reason that project started. So maybe tell us a little bit about what is the Stratix versus the other products that are out there, and what things can we look at and know that this is a Stratix project, and what makes it like commonality in the Stratix projects?
Sure, absolutely. So the Stratix project started in 2015, and like you mentioned, from Reddit, which is kind of an online community message board, if you will. And there's a flying group on there, and two people were just talking about ADS-B technology and how the only thing available was a Stratix, which costs around $1,000 at the time. They thought that they could build something that had ADS-B without being proprietary and that would work with different kinds of software. So these people got talking. One of them had a very tech background. He was a programmer. And he made this software, which is open source, which means anyone's free to download and use it. Like I said, kind of a community development. So the product developed, and originally they had the software that worked on a Raspberry Pi, which is basically a little computer board that you can buy from Amazon or anywhere else, pretty inexpensive. And along the way, different people contributed from different parts of the world. So the guy who made the software, his name is Chris up in Michigan. A guy named Ryan up in Canada designed some injection molded cases and mounts. Dan, who lives near Philadelphia, designed some high-gain antennas. And so all these people contributed to this project to make a product that was actually outperforms a lot of the things that are out there on the market. I went and flight tested a Scout and flight tested it against the Stratix receiver, and actually got a much better reception on the Stratix because you have high-gain antennas, and what you kind of lose in form factor, you get in performance. So it's really been interesting being involved with these people, and actually I met a lot of them for the first time here at Oshkosh. So I've been talking and collaborating with them over the internet over the past year, and it was great for us to all kind of finally come together and meet in person. But all of them have this very this great enthusiasm for aviation and this idea that, you know, things should be shared. They shouldn't be just proprietary. They want this to be available for anyone. And so, you know, these products, you can either buy them pre-built from some different companies, or you can go, even me personally, I have a YouTube channel, Crew Dog Electronics. I show you how I build the unit from start to finish. So it's out there for hobbyists or people that don't know a lot about technology and want to buy a kit that's already done for you, just to screw in some antennas, that's available as well.
Yeah, in fact, you gave me a unit to mess around with, and here we are in Oshkosh, and I'm camping out on the North 40, and their facilities are not exactly ideal for building electronics. And I had no trouble in the tent just putting all the pieces together. Literally, taking them out of the bags took longer than putting the unit together. So that was very convenient. And it's already stuck to my window, and I'm looking forward to flying home with it over the week. Question about, you mentioned that the taxpayers have already paid for the availability of this information, and therefore having to pay $1,000 for a unit to get this taxpayer dollared information doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's the only thing that was out there. And I can certainly attest to myself having to go through that process. So I really appreciate that not only are you putting this whole project together, making it available, but you're saving me the time from soldering things together and wiring it up. What exactly is your kind of a business model? What's the value proposition for the general public, flying public, of buying your unit?
So great. I appreciate all the feedback on that. And I, like I said, I spent a lot of time instructing the Air Force in KC-10. KC-10s, and also as a CFI in Hawaii. So I take pride in being able to teach and explain things to people in a way that makes sense. So I put a lot of time and effort into my YouTube videos, and for me, it's a way to kind of project a way to teach people flying, but not on a one-on-one basis, but I've reached thousands of people. Some of the videos that I have on how to either assemble your own Stratix unit or troubleshoot yours, I've got tens of thousands of views on these. So for me, the value add is you can assemble it on your own, or you can buy it from one of the vendors, which I happen to be one, and you're getting tech support. I actually offer people email addresses and a phone number they can text, and I answer it twice a day. So you're really getting support for the product if you're not someone who's technically savvy and you just want to save some time and have something that's pretty much done for you and that you can assemble in a couple of minutes.
That's exactly why I was interested in taking a look at your product, because despite being tech savvy and having a workshop and lots of things in various states of undress and reassembly, I found that the value proposition for not having to do all that myself was just really, really great. So as far as, like, are you, people can buy it on Amazon, they can buy it directly from you. Do you have any other sales channels?
Yeah, also I have my website, crewdogelectronics.com, so you can go there, buy directly from me, and then I ship out, and actually saves me a little bit on fees, so that's the preferred method. But like I said, Amazon as well, and I'm doing the first time sales in person here at Oshkosh.
And of course, what are your price points or ranges, or what are kind of options do people have when they're buying the units from you?
So what I try to do is make it very simple, so that the kit I sell on Amazon has a unit, has the antennas, it comes with a battery, comes with a mount and a strap. So basically it comes together, all assembles in a little unit that you can suction cup to your either the window or put it out somewhere else. But also there's a bare bones model that's available for $200 online that's just the unit itself with the antennas. And that's for people that already have a battery kit that they use, or you can also plug it directly into the plane. It just uses a USB cable. So those are two price points, $250 for everything, which is, you know, the battery, the strap, everything just done for you, or $200 for just the bare bones kit.
Bare bones kit or with the battery backup. And I suppose people would want a battery backup in case they don't either have readily easy access to getting ship's power. So if someone was reasonably tech savvy and they wanted to do this themselves, what would you think it would take for them to do it, to figure out how to do it? And I'm assuming that your product comes already with the software flashed onto it and you don't have to learn how to do that and do that. So if someone had the skills but has never done one before, what kind of time are they looking at?
Yeah, if you have the skills but you haven't done it before, I'd say in about an hour you could probably do this. I have a video on YouTube on my channel, Crew Like Electronics, and I've actually got a list of parts at the bottom, and those are all from one of the project founders, Chris Young, and he actually makes a lot of the products. And I'd just like to say there's some other knockoff brands out there, and they're not really the best quality, so I'd highly encourage you, if you're going to build this on your own, to look at my video and get the parts list that I have for Amazon. But really the thing you're buying if you buy from me or one of the other vendors is you're getting a unit that's already tested. If you have anything wrong, you can just interact with me or one of the other vendors. They will solve it for you. So you're saving yourself a lot of time. But like I said, for hobbyists who really want to do it, encourage you to go watch the video.
So you provided both the video and the finished product. And if I recall correctly from speaking with your people earlier, also if there are updates to the software, we come back to you for it if we buy the product from you.
Yes, absolutely. And I have the YouTube channel, and I try to do little segments with troubleshooting, so it makes it easy for people, because pictures are worth 1,000 words, but I think a video is worth 10,000 words. So little things like troubleshooting your GPS, updating your software, which is free, of course, I update on that on the Crew Dog Electronics Facebook page, and then I'll put out little videos for how to do these things. But this software has been out for around 3 years now. Pretty stable. There's no real major updates planned. And it's, I would say, if you're buying a version now, it's going to work with every major electronic flight bag software except for Garmin, so you won't really need to worry about updating it too much.
That was, in fact, my next question. So like you said, Sean, every electronic flight bag software, and what we mean by that would be 4Flight, iFly, IQ, X, WingX, and so on. It's, all those are compatible except for Garmin's Pilot, because that's proprietary to their panel hardware. So that's super. So anybody who wants to just fly away with one, order it from Amazon or from your Crew Dog Electronics website, and they'll have a completed unit ready to go. You mentioned the cost before. You mentioned how people can get it. Is there anything else you want people to know?
Yeah, I just want to say that this is very much a community-based project, all open source. If you are purchasing one of these units or building one yourself, I encourage you to connect with the community. There's a Stratix pilot group on Facebook. Last I checked, I think 2,000 users. But people with all different kinds of airplanes or powered gliders. And they're helping each other out, talking about ways they can mount it. They're giving each other tips and tricks on software they're using in different settings. So I'd encourage you to, if you do end up buying one of these units, to reach out with the community and talk to some other users. Or read some of the reviews on Amazon to see how other people are using it. And the piece that I really enjoy is connecting with people that fly using my unit. So during Hurricane Harvey, I had people reaching out to me saying how they use this unit to deconflict traffic. I actually had a former astronaut reach out to me a couple days ago asking me on how to update his firmware. So I really love hearing the flying stories. So if you end up purchasing a unit from me, please feel free to reach out. Tell me how you're using it. I love hearing feedback from customers.
Thank you very much, Sean. This is really interesting information. I think it's just wonderful that you've taken this project on and making it productizable, if you want to call it that. Appreciate your time, and I hope you're enjoying Oshkosh. I hope it's successful for you. You've been listening to Hillel in the Hangar, wishing for you to be clear and unlimited.
Next, Hillel spoke with the founder of SkyVector, provider of aeronautical charts, online mapping, and related flight planning products and services.
Hello, this is Hillel in the Hangar. I'm at AirVenture 2018, known throughout the aviation geekdom simply as Oshkosh. You can hear by the background noise there are aircraft flying. We'll probably be interrupted a number of times, but that's what it is here at Oshkosh. With me today, I have David Graves, founder of SkyVector. Dave, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Tell us, what is SkyVector?
SkyVector is a website that you can use to plan your flight. You can view weather information and airport data, hopefully find a cheap fuel stop if you're making a long flight. All available online.
Super. So this is right now an internet-based product.
Correct. It's a website, so it's going to be useful for you when you're on the ground before you get up in the air. You're going to need to probably use something else to fly by.
In the universe of available things that need to be done, why did you choose to do this?
It was a personal need. So I was originally a programmer and had a little disposable income and wanted to learn to fly, so this was checking off an item off my bucket list. While I was in ground school, we started learning how to make a flight plan, and they had us pull out our sectionals and plotters and start drawing lines on the chart, and that was a lot of fun, but I decided there needs to be a way to do this online.
That's great. So you basically said, I've had it with this old school stuff and decided to make something in the 21st century that was readily available.
Well, I've always been a little bit fussy about precision, and I didn't like the imprecise calculations that the E6B gave me, that, you know, the wind correction angles were done in an analog way, and I wanted a digital answer. And so I really wanted a computer to help me with the exact flight planning math. And so that was the need I wanted to fill for myself, and as it turns out, I shared it with everyone, and they liked it too.
Yeah, I've been using it. I don't remember where and when I found out about SkyVector, but I loved it from the minute I found it somehow magically. So how long have you been at this?
So SkyVector actually went online in 2006. It really became a company in 2010. That's when I quit my day job, and it's been a going concern since then.
SkyVector is actually a money-making operation in some respects.
Yes, it is profitable.
Oh, good for you. So what? And your background, you mentioned you were a developer, software developer?
Yeah, I'd always worked in, various startups. You know, I was, I think I was writing some e-commerce software at the time when I was learning to fly.
So that's pretty cool. Your background was not aviation, but it came from the technology side, and you just happened to have a bunch of skills that met a need that you could fulfill with your newly found aviation.
I would call it a passion.
Passion. Yeah, there we go. That's a great.
You are correct. I originally was making a living doing other things, but once you get bitten by the aviation bug, it kind of consumes you.
Yeah, it's been, I guess, now 12 years. Wow, that's incredible. That's just shy of how long I've been flying. I've been a user for quite some time. I can't recall exactly when I started using it. It was probably in the 2009, 2010 timeframe. And along the way, right about the first time I came to Oshkosh, you had made some major changes to the product. I mean, you took a lot of heat for it, but you stuck to your guns and to your idea, and you succeeded. How did you know that would work?
Well, I don't think anybody knew it would work. So what you're talking about specifically is when we launched our second generation flight planner. The first one we had was pretty simplistic. It didn't calculate winds. It didn't let you file or you know, create an aircraft profile or any of that. So we launched an updated version that added a whole bunch of those features that I had heard requests for over the years. But I think the misstep was that we ended up taking away some features that we didn't realize how much people liked. Specifically, people were using it to do multi-leg flight planning, and that's something we still don't support very well. But it's, you know, we made some changes to sort of bring back the old style, not in its original form, but still accommodating some of the new features and let them have it, you know, their way. There was a regrettable delay in being able to roll that out of about 4 or 5 months, in which we were, you know, hearing a chorus of requests to go back to the old planner while we stood up what we call the replacement.
Well, that's actually really commendable, because in this world of software and aviation in particular, it's really hard to have a voice as a user to the people making the product. Like, go over a couple of tents from here and they're not going to listen to you no matter how right you are.
Yeah.
But you actually took the feedback and said, okay, we'll bring it back, and you learned from it and you brought it back. And I know the functionality to do it is not quite exactly the way it used to be, but it is back.
Yep.
And I appreciate that as a user, and I appreciate that you as a developer are listening to the consumer and listening to the customers and saying, okay, you guys like this, let's bring it back. How much does it cost to use SkyVector?
Well, the product is free for users, and we want to keep it that way. You know, we believe that
You said free for users.
Yes, zero cost to the pilots.
Okay, so you don't even have to you can sign in, create a profile to, you know, keep store your filing, your plans, and your planes, but you don't otherwise have to put in a credit card for anything.
Nope. So we don't even have an e-commerce part of the site for you to take your money.
So you must be making money in some other way, which we'll just not go there for now.
Well, I don't mind giving you the high-level view. It's about 20% advertising and about 80% consulting. So we license our technology, our content, and my programming time will sell out to anyone who wants it.
Well, from a product development and product management perspective, I think that's a really cool story, because what you're saying is that you've got a product that you built from scratch that has got enough value in the market that people are hiring you to do what you did in SkyVector for them.
Correct. So our largest client is Airink Direct, which is a business aviation flight planning solution that is really sophisticated. And they came to us and said, hey, we really like your mapping interface. Can you give that to us?
And this is all for the, to interrupt you, sorry. This is all, the SkyVector for the consumer, however, is available just at SkyVector.com.
Correct.
So you're not even going through your company's site, to like the marketing side, to go find SkyVector.com. You go SkyVector.com and you're right into the online application.
Right.
That's fabulous. So what's next? What's going to happen with SkyVector from here on out?
We're pretty busy with a lot of fun projects for our clients, but the one we're working on the most for ourselves is going to be our app. So we're going to finally solve that solution that we talked about at the beginning of this show, which is, what do you do in flight after you've created your plan on the ground?
So we're going to see a transition from where you can plan online on a computer, tablet, or whatever, and then log in to your account or some other way of transferring that to something on a tablet or a phone format and pick up where you left off?
Correct. We want to take all of the features of SkyVector offline in the air with you.
Would we be using it like an EFB?
It'll be in the same class of product as an EFB or an in-flight flight planner.
Right. So next thing you know, you're going to be building Stratix.
Well, we don't want to necessarily get into the hardware, but we certainly do love that whole product, the whole space there of ADS-B receivers. So that's going to be an irresistible feature.
Do you think you're going to, this is just a completely nerdy question, you think you'll open source the project to be able to have a sustainable community online, even though you know, require licensing for particular downloads and products as an app, but as far as trying to, you know, grow something the way Stratix did or some of the other products that are out there?
At this point, we're not considering doing that, only because I think it's an extremely competitive market space, and if we, you know, we're counting on being able to sell this app as a non-free part of SkyVector, and I don't think we could do that if you could build it yourself.
So if they wanted to get in touch with you, or if the people out there listening wanted to, obviously they can go to SkyVector.com just to use the app, but if there was some way people wanted to otherwise communicate, can they get there through SkyVector.com?
Yeah, so we have an About Us page that's got various contact information, including our physical address and phone numbers. We welcome users to call us or visit us, but just keep in mind, we don't really have a help desk. We don't really have the manpower.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to demand some services for a free product, right?
Exactly.
But people do it anyway.
Well, we love talking to pilots. That's why we come to Oshkosh. That's why, you know, we do have an outreach program. We're also reachable on various social media platforms, so you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And
yeah, in fact, we first met, I think, 4 years ago at Oshkosh, but that was after we had communicated by email over some inane comment or question that I had, and you were very responsive to it, which is why, you know, which is why we keep coming back to see you.
Well, I like to hear I'm responsive because I'm not always, so at least that's one data point in my
favor. I got you at a lucky moment.
Exactly.
Got it. Well, is there anything else you want to include in our conversation here? I appreciate you taking the time. It's pretty busy in the hangars at Heritage. It's a great Oshkosh for a lot of people out here.
You know, this year actually was better than most. I think the weather, for whatever reason, was really nice this week. It was a little bit cooler than we're used to, and I think the pilots stuck around longer. You know, we're talking now, it's Saturday afternoon, and there's still a lot of pilots at the show, and that's not always the case.
Yeah, it's very true. In fact, I was worried we wouldn't be able to talk to you again. Thank you very much for joining me today, David. And it's been, you've been listening to Hillel in the Hangar, wishing you all to be very clear and unlimited.
Thank you, Hillel.
All systems are go. We are ready. Sir, insert your key. Turn your keys in 3, 2, 1, turn. I have a launch enable light.
Podcast is away.
That's right. Airplane Geeks reporter at large Launchpad Marzari visited the Titan Missile Museum, the only remaining Titan II site open to the public. It's located in Green Valley, Arizona, a short distance south of Tucson.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. It's reporter at large Launchpad Marzari. And we're down here in Tucson, Arizona, and we've stumbled across a really cool place that Airplane Geeks should stop and visit, because we're here at...
We're at the Titan Missile Museum, Green Valley, Arizona.
And I'm here with...
Charlie Schultz.
Listeners, when you're standing up here in the desert, it's just a big flat piece of concrete with like a visitor center building. But that's not what's important.
No, we actually have the tallest building in Arizona between Tucson and Nogales. It's all underground, however. It's 9 levels underground, 3 primary levels in the control center, and 9 levels in the silo where the missile is stored.
So this is a fully restored, I was almost going to say functional. It's not functional anymore, but it's a fully restored, used to be operational missile silo.
Right, correct. It was on alert during the Cold War for approximately 20 years, had in it a Titan II missile with a warhead on it that was the largest warhead that we used on any system up to this day even.
Okay, and this museum is open to the public. You can come visit it and take the tours.
Right, we're open every day except Christmas, and we have tours on the hour during the summertime, and during the winter we have more frequent hours when we have more winter visitors in southern Arizona.
And there's special programs where you can do top to bottoms and spend the night and all sorts of educational tours.
Correct. Our basic tour is a one-hour tour. You get to see a movie and a launch, and you get to go down into the control center, and you get to go out to level 2 to actually see the missile in the silo.
And right now, we got to do part of that. Let's play some audio from that. I have a valid launch order.
I concur.
First message decodes. We have X-ray Bravo message. Sir, we have a valid launch order. I have a green light.
All circuit breakers are closed. Batteries powered up.
Sir, insert your key. Turn your keys in 3, 2, 1, turn. I have a launch enable light. Release. I have battery activated. Batteries are powered up.
Warhead has accepted lockout code.
Silo doors are open. Guidance is go. Engine ignition, and we have liftoff. Missile has left the silo. Well, that was exciting and gave you a sense of almost a little dread and a lot of history.
Correct. That's what we try and show here is the role that this particular system played in the Cold War and a little bit of history about the Cold War overall and the part that the United States military played in that particular situation.
Okay, now that I've simulated turning, or I actually turned the key, do I get to call myself a steely-eyed missile man?
No, not quite. You've got a little more training to go through before that happens.
Oh, okay. All right, Airplane Geek listeners, we've moved. And holy cow, Charlie, what's up above my head?
Well, what you're looking up at is the Titan II missile. It's approximately 103 feet long, and it's about 12 feet in diameter. And that particular missile, when it was active, was the was going to generate about 340,000 or 430,000 pounds of thrust to get that missile out of the silo.
Yeah, these giant engines above our head. And as I look down on the grate beneath us to get all that thrust out of the way, there's this giant UW or double flame troughs. What are we doing to get the flames out of the way?
Well, the engine actually had two thrust chambers, and one was positioned over each side of this trough. And if you looked at it from the side, it would look very much like a W. And these troughs, as they directed the exhaust down and then up, and it ran parallel through chambers outside of where the missile is actually being stored, through chambers, and it exited at the top, and it was driven out away from the missile at about a 45-degree angle.
So there's like two chimneys running parallel in the silo to prevent all this exhaust plumes from coming up when the missile is trying to travel out to the exhaust.
That's correct. And that got rid of the exhaust, but it didn't get rid of the biggest problem, which was the noise problem. The bigger problem was the noise generated as a result of the actual detonation that occurred in the engines of the fuel in the oxidizer. And that noise level reached approximately 185 decibels, which would certainly destroy any human being, but if left unattended, would have certainly destroyed the missile before it ever left the silo.
I was going to say, at 185 decibels, we're getting at the point where sound becomes energy and we start bending metal and breaking things.
That's correct. And it was necessary in order to be able to successfully launch from down within or down underground within the silo itself. We had to contend with that noise and dissipate or get rid of that noise. And that was done in two ways. One of them was an acoustic box. It was lined the entire full length of the launch duct from the very bottom to the top.
Okay, fans, and what we're looking at to one of these is these are all about 10 inches deep, and they're curved, and they've got a screen on them, and they're filled with fiberglass, I don't know, 18 inches, 2 feet tall, and they wrap around for about 2 feet, so you can bolt and change them out. But these are what the inside of the silo is, these boxes full of grate and fiberglass.
That's correct. They actually covered the structure that was the launch duct itself, which was a quarter-inch plate steel wall on the inside. And these boxes were extended out from that wall, and that helped keep the sound from echoing or vibrating off or reflecting off of that steel plate. That was one part of the sound attenuation system. The other one was using water, and this was a process or a system that was devised by the British, and they shared that information with the United States military, and we were able to use it as well. Our earlier systems did not have this sound attenuation capability, so our earlier systems actually had to be raised above ground on a large elevator, and then they were launched from that position. The Titan II, we wanted to be able to launch it from down within the silo, so we copied from the British a system using water. And there was a 100,000-gallon water tank in the missile silo underground. That water was directed on the engines. It was actually started going into the engine area before the engines actually fired up.
In like a giant sprinkler.
It was more like four huge hoses. These four pipes were about 6 or 8 inches in diameter at the end where the water came out. And the water comes out at about 150 gallons per second. And that water, when it comes out, when those engines fire up, that water, the molecules in the water are heated up. As they heat up from the flame and from the noise causes the molecules to vibrate. They expand, and as they expand, we eventually get steam, and that's absorbing a lot of that sound energy. So we reduce that 185 decibels down and making it possible to have that engine burn for a couple of seconds, actually, before it actually is released. So it doesn't just immediately release when the engine's fired up. There's a few seconds while the engines spin up and get up to the thrust. And during that time, that noise is generated. And that water coming in there helps attenuate that sound and make it possible for the missile to survive and leave the silo. And it was successful. After it was tested, we did routine launches to check that out.
Listeners, now we've learned something more. We've learned that it isn't just exhaust, it's sound. And we now got geeky on how we're going to do sound attenuation for a launch. Well, Charles, I'd like to thank you for taking a moment to talk to our listeners. Listeners, frequency change approved. Good day.
Years ago, my wife and I visited the Titan Missile Museum the day after touring the Pima Air and Space Museum. What a great trip that was. And speaking of museums, as regular listeners know, for a number of years, the Airplane Geeks have been fortunate enough to be invited by the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum to participate in their Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation display. That's the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, adjacent to Dulles. Well, Micah provides his observations from the 2018 event.
Innovations in Flight, Udvar-Hazy Center 2018, the inside story. Visiting the Smithsonian Institution Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center, just outside of Washington, D.C. in Chantilly, Virginia, is always an incredible experience. But being able to do that during their Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation Display makes it even more special. This year was the fourth time I was fortunate enough to be able to do that, and a third time I was able to join the Airplane Geeks as part of the day-long adventure of recording a podcast right there on the floor of the museum. This year's visit was even better than ever, but I say that every year. It turned into a big inter-podcast meetup with the Airline Pilot Guy and the Flying in Life podcast coming to join us. Flying in Life even hosted a big cookout party the night before the event, which started the weekend as a grand occasion, but it only got better and better. Let me tell you how. You've heard me say this before, probably using other words, but I simply can't get over the sense of wonder experiencing the awe of being in the Udvar-Hazy Center, standing next to the Enola Gay, the Dash 80, Concorde, and all the other artifact aircraft on display. It's striking. It's electrifying. But it's also reverent. Each time I've been there, something new strikes me. The first time, I was overwhelmed by the entrance, seeing the F4U Corsair suspended in midair in front of me at the main entrance, hearing it call to me and pulling me to the railing of the second floor to look down at the SR-71 Blackbird that looks like it's cruising at Mach 2, even when it's standing still. The second time, entering from the rear hangar and walking in on the tail end of the C-69 Constellation, seeing her scraggly undercarriage, her landing gear looking like the legs of a flamingo. The third time I was there, I arrived through the same rear entrance with good friend and former Airplane Geeks associate producer Brian Coleman. We arrived earlier than necessary and realized we had the museum, all three hangars, practically to ourselves. What a treat. This year was no exception. Arriving early with Brian, we entered an almost empty museum at about 08:30. But this time it was different. We got to experience a museum in a new and incredulous way. You see, in the car with us was an accountant we all know and love, who works at a medium-sized Midwestern airport and who had never been to the Udvar-Hazy Center before. We walked in the door with Jennifer Adams, whose whole face lit up. In fact, her eyes were so aglow that if it had been so dark as to need a flashlight, Jen's eyes could have lit up the whole room. It was the start of what turned into an incredible day. I knew exactly where we were going and wanted to get to our table so we could start setting up, find the electrical outlets, and get the Wi-Fi password of the day. Together, the three of us walked quickly, and I'm not sure if I had more fun visiting old friends, meaning the aircraft we were walking past, or watching Jennifer as she alternated between ear-to-ear grins and jaw drops of wonder. We found our table, dropped off a few things, and walked over to get our flight line briefing so we could head outside later in the day. Just a bit later, I was looking around for someone from the IT department and stopped for a moment to take a selfie with Mercury Capsule 15B, Freedom 7-2. I got photobombed by none other than dispatcher Mike Carells of the Flying in Life podcast and Captain Jeff Nielsen, the airline pilot guy himself. Can it get better than catching up with two good friends at one of the holy places of aviation history? Apparently it can, but if you tried to tell me that ahead of time, I might not have believed you. Jeff, Mike, and I said our hellos and got caught up from the night before, and I went back to the table. This was when it started to get better. Max Flight and Drone Mama were there, and David Vanderhoof showed up a few minutes later. It was then it started to get busy, really busy. We said our hellos, but had to set up for recording interviews. We were connecting 4 microphones, 5 headphones, tablets, laptops, digital recorders, cables, adapters, extensions. It was a spiderweb of technology and lines. Good thing we live in a wireless world now, huh? It was close to opening, 10 a.m., and we gave it a test. We knew it would be perfect and all would be smooth. After all, how many times have we done this? Surprise, it wasn't. We had some glitches. We couldn't hear each other in the headphones. One mic wasn't working. It was a mess. But you know what? For me, it was kind of a fun mess. Here I am with Max Flight, podcast king and technical guru, troubleshooting audio problems and finding workarounds. Sure, it was nerve-wracking. We both knew we'd find a means to make it work, and we did. Although we were about an hour late, it was still a great start. While Max and I were working out the tech glitches, David and Brian were lining up guests. They weren't quite back yet when we were ready, so I went to find a few guests too. Like I said earlier, this was the 4th time I was able to join the Airplane Geeks at Innovations in Flight, and from my perspective, it was the busiest. I think we had more guests than ever before. So many, in fact, we had to line them up, ask some to come back later in the day. I don't remember that ever happening before. We managed to interview 15 different guests in less than 4 hours. Some new to the show, some old friends, all great guests. It got so busy that we almost missed lunch. Not something that typically happens with this food-loving group. A couple of us never made it outside to the flight line. But think about it. Think about the quality. From a little after 11 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon is about 4 hours. Add in breaks, time between guests, time finding guests, and maybe it comes down to 3 or 3 1/4 hours of recording. After Max's editing, that week's show was 2 hours and 49 minutes long. That really demonstrates the quality of the guests we had. Did I mention the day got only better? After packing up, we were ready to head back to the hotel and meet at the Red Robin. I told you, we're a food-loving group. Beer-loving, too, come to think of it. Brian and I left with an old high school friend of his, as well as Captain Rick Bell and his first officer. We headed out to the car and got to do some plane spotting on the way. What did we get to see together? A Lufthansa 747-800 coming in for a landing, followed by a 787 Dreamliner. It was the first time I got to see a 787. It sure is sleek. It was followed by a 777. We could have stayed there and watched airplanes for hours, but we also had food and drink on our minds, so we left for the meetup. When we arrived at the Red Robin in Chantilly, we got our usual long table, and soon after that, the beer started flowing. Brian was across from me, Rick Bell next to me on one side. On my other side was Chief NASA historian Bill Barry, and next to him, Max Flight and Drone Mama. Further down the table was Captain Jeff, Dispatcher Mike, Airplane Geek historian David Vanderhoof, Jennifer Adams, Hillel, Tanya, my brother Rick, and my niece Hannah. Gosh, there had to be close to 20 or 30 of us. And please, I apologize for leaving out any names. It was a long table. But it was a non-stop festival of hangar talk, hamburgers, french fries, beer, and camaraderie. Like all good parties, though, it had to eventually end. Eventually it got late and people started to say their goodbyes. It was sad, but it was also special. In fact, maybe one of the most special moments of the weekend happened then. You see, sometimes, even good friends can have some miscommunications or misunderstandings between them. Oftentimes, they can go unspoken and can last a long time. They tend to be indirect, lingering, and can very unintentionally be cause for a lot of hurt feelings. It's especially true with friends that don't see each other that often. We've all had this happen and have felt what I'm describing. So where am I going with this? Well, at the end of the evening, one of my friends, someone I care about a great deal, yet had been concerned I'd offended or distanced, let me know that all was well. This person must have sensed my feelings and took the time in a tiny private moment to let me know we were okay and still very close. Of all the wonderful things that happened during this visit to the Udvar-Hazy Center, this one was just the greatest, and one I had to find a way to share with you. Sometimes it's the tiniest moments that make the biggest impact. So that's it. That's my summary report, the inside story of my 2018 trip to Chantilly, Virginia. I wish you could have been there with me, but I guess in some ways you were. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Micah sent along some pictures from our day at the Udvar-Hazy Center. You can see them in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/519. Next, Brian attended an exhibit at the Peekaboo Gallery based on the Pan Am Experience. Here's Brian.
Hi, this is Brian, and I'm here at the Peekaboo Gallery in Pasadena, California with Jordan Rychek. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
We're here looking at a fairly unique exhibit. At least I think that it's unique here in Pasadena. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's called The Friendly Skies, The Art of High Altitude Travel. And just a little bit about us, we're a pop culture art gallery. We kind of coined ourselves the pop culture time machine. What we do is celebrate 20th century pop culture in a gallery setting. So it's an experiential presentation celebrating all sides of whatever given genre of 20th century culture we decide to exhibit. And everything is for sale. Mm-hmm. This particular one is obviously on commercial air travel of the 20th century. It covers everything from travel posters to airline models to stewardess uniforms, original artwork, anything that showcases what commercial air travel is about.
And it's all available for sale.
Yes, it is. It's available on our website. If you go to peekaboogallery.com, that will lead you to our shop, which will have our online catalog of everything that's available. And there's a lot more available than even what's on display on the floor here.
And it looks like the flight attendant uniforms are spanning from the 40s through the 60s they have on display here. Tell our listeners a little bit about the uniforms that are on display.
Yeah, it's an exceptional offering. Actually, has never been offered in this volume before. We have over 70 uniforms. They date from the mid-40s or early 40s up through the 2000s. And we carry everything from Pan Am to United to Delta, TWA. We even have Aeroflot, the Soviet airline. Mm-hmm. But it culminates, the jewel of the collection is our Emilio Pucci line from Braniff International Airways that dates from the mid-60s through the late 70s.
And then you also have some pretty interesting models available as well.
Yeah, we have incredible promotional models that would be given to executives at different airlines basically as a bribe by the manufacturers. So let's say Lockheed had their new Constellation coming out. Well, you know, when they pitched it to the executives over at TWA, let's say Howard Hughes, hey, we're going to dump this on his desk, and how could he say no to order 40 of them?
Right, and it's certainly a beautiful piece that you have. Do you know what it retails for?
That one, I believe, retails for $5,800.
You also have a really great collection of the promotional posters that you might find in a travel agency.
Basically, the posters all come out of competition between the different airlines. During the period where fares were regulated, all the airlines needed to compete with each other on a promotional level, so they got some of the top illustrators to represent their airline to draw you to buy from them as opposed to someone else because the ticket prices were all the same. What came out of that was incredible graphic art. And we have pieces by David Klein, who was the main illustrator for TWA. Mm-hmm. And that sword rattling between TWA was with United, and United had Stan Galley. So we have some of the most highly sought posters in first printings available here at the gallery.
Yeah, and a few of them showing Southern California as well, which is kind of nice.
We went out of our way to try to get some of the Southern California ones here, just because we knew the client base here was going to really like them.
Right, and then you have some travel bags. Are they original travel bags or are they reproductions? I'm assuming they're for sale as well.
Yes, the travel bags are all for sale. We started off with about 150 of them. We're down to about less than 30. They went really quick, but they're all original. They're all new old stock, so they're not issued or used ones. But it's a testament to what air travel was back then in comparison to what it is today, because a lot of these travel bags were given away promotionally for free. And now they charge you to bring your own bag on a flight. So.
Yeah, definitely aware of that and all the charges. So on last week's show, we were talking about all of the charges that the airlines have.
The sneeze charge.
Yeah, it's a charge for breathing air.
Exactly. So, yeah. Well, at least you're not having to breathe in cigarillos.
Yes, because the smoke in the airplane respected the dividing line of the smoking and non-smoking section. Yeah. Well, you really have a fantastic collection here. So glad that you gave us a little tour of it. And hopefully our listeners can check you out online. So what's the website?
The website is www.peekaboogallery.com. And if you go to our shop, we have the full catalog available because there's much more available than what's on the floor here. But I also would push you in the direction of our social media. We're at Peekaboo Gallery on Instagram, and you can see a lot of the presentation if you're not here locally to walk the exhibit.
Very cool. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Our European contributor, Peter Johnson, has an Across the Pond segment for us. He talks with Neil McCarthy, a 20-year civilian pilot with over 800 hours on military jets. Neil has a habit of taking on new aviation projects every year, and having last talked to Neil in 2012, Peter hears about his latest projects, which include a full-size 737 flight simulator and his return to general aviation flying.
Neil, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's been a very long time since I've last seen you. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for the invitation to have a chat again, but much appreciated.
No, well, you've just come back from a flight across Europe, which I'd like to come back and talk to you about. But What a journey you've been on since I saw you at Yeovilton in 2012. I think you were flying the Jet Provost and the Hawker Hunter at that time. And we had a tour around, I think, the Provost. You've started a flight sim centre. You've got a fully functioning 737 amongst other goodies. So I want to ask you about that. You've qualified as an air show director. You've bought yourself a Piper Cherokee 6. You've started a sightseeing service, and you're flying all around Europe. You've lived the dream. What a roller coaster time you've had, but brilliant journey.
I never stop. And don't forget, in between all of that, I rescued and saved and then refurbed and became a very famous De Havilland Vampire cockpit section. And of course, not forgetting the old, I built a full size Spitfire replica aircraft as well, which we
you
took to
did.
Many shows. So
yes, you did.
I've done something every year, I think. Because I was thinking about this the other day, actually, and it's been in the last eight years, I have always done something, some project somewhere to do with aviation, to promote aviation. And as you quite rightly say, we've now got we've moved on further, and we've gone back to the real thing, and we've got a Cherokee 6 now. But yeah, every year for the last 8 years, since about 2010, I've done something.
Wow. all in aviation. And bless your wife.
Yes.
She still smiles.
She does.
Or maybe she's laughing behind your back. I can't quite work out which.
I don't know which either. I have to say I'm very lucky. She is very supportive. It takes a lot of persuading. I've got to convince her, but why not? You know, we'll give it a go and see what happens, you know.
So yeah.
She's very supportive.
Wonderful, wonderful. So since flying the Hunter and the Provost, obviously there's been some big changes in the UK. You're still, I did see you jumping into a Hawker Hunter, did I not, at Bruntingthorpe recently?
That's right, yes. Obviously, Bruntingthorpe, the attacks, all the old RAF jets, Buccaneers, Hunters, Jet Provost, VC-10s. And, you know, at the end of the day, they are big. I mean, the Hunters, 11.5 tons, it's a big bit of kit. You need somebody who knows what they're doing. Obviously, at this time, and possibly ever will be, I was the last civilian pilot qualified to fly a Hawker Hunter, and that's probably at the minute looking unlikely to change forever. Unfortunately. So obviously with my significant jet time, 20 years flying jets and experience doing that, it got to the point where I got very kindly invited to come along and will you taxi these aircraft for me? And obviously you kind of miss the opportunity not to taxi hunters and buccaneers and jet pros and whatever else, you know. And it's a great honor to do that. And keeping these fantastic aircraft in a good taxiing condition is what it's all about, and showing the public. Up close, at an air show, you don't get to see these things at all. Up in the air, you do, but not right up close. And only up close, you see how big a Hunter is. It's a big machine.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get to make a bit of noise.
And you do yourself a disservice by saying taxiing. This is not actually taxiing, is it? It's pretty fast. They're runway runs, aren't they?
Frankly, Brunton Fob is a big, long American, ex-American Air Force base, big runway. And the short answer is we give it full welly, or ask them to do it. But we're there for, and we go full power. And they're quite light on fuel, and they haven't got any rockets and bombs and missiles on. So the acceleration is, quite frankly, breathtaking. It's wow. Yeah. It's a way.
And do you miss flying the Hunter and the Provost?
From a flying point of view, I wouldn't say I miss it, because at the end of the day, I did it for 20 years of my life.
Yeah.
And with that 20 years came, it got more and more red tape. So for every 1 hour flying, I was doing something like 20 hours of administration somewhere along the line, whether it was to do with the group or the Civil Aviation Authority or something like that. And, you know, when you get towards the 800 hours mark and 20 years, and you've ticked all the boxes, you've flew in formation with Vulcans and Lancasters, and you've done every air show in England and nearly in Europe, it kind of ticked all the boxes. And then, to be honest, when I stopped flying them aircraft, it was a fantastic relief, because as a display pilot, to do a 6-minute air display in the aircraft, you were having to finish work on a Friday and take the Friday off work and go down to an air show and overnight in a hotel, and then you all the hassle of the actual air show itself, all for 6 minutes. In fact, them 6 minutes were the best 6 minutes going, because peace, quiet, nobody on the radio, just you flying around. Perfect, you know. Yeah. But then when you land, you've got all the administration and then all the paperwork and the regulations and whatever else, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've got to fly back home. You kind of get back home because of the weather's turned bad, or something goes wrong with the aircraft. So what would, for a 6-minute display, you were having 4 days off work. And when you're doing 22, 23 air displays a year, in my case, the short answer is I never had any holidays for myself or for the family. And, you know, the wife wasn't too keen on that. And when the kids were younger, it was okay. But when they started getting a bit older, they're missing out as well. So from my point of view, when it all came to the finish, I was quite happy. And I still am. You know, I don't miss any bit at all. I did it all, seen it all. No, don't miss it at all. I mean, it'd be great to get into Hunter again and fly it again. Don't get me wrong. Of course it would. But as we now seen since the Shawm crash, things are flagged up about the aircraft themselves and the maintenance records and how, you know, at the end of the day, these aircraft haven't been fully serviced and fully overhauled for 30, 40, 50 years in some aircraft case. And, you know, when you think of things like piston provosts and up to Hunters, what could be lying buried deep in that engine, and, you know, I'm a family man now, and you just think, well, is it worth the risk? You know, something goes wrong in the flight I'm in, and who knows what repercussions I could have with the family. We've now seen the true extent what can happen if something does go wrong. It's not just me, the aircraft, it's other external people, it's the family, it's the whole industry. Is it worth that risk? It's a fairly selfish thing to do. For me, when it came to a head, no, I'm happy. Been there, done it all. Last guy flying the Hunt, highest hour on Jet Provost, probably in the world, possibly civilian. I'm happy with that. I'll close that door.
Right. Well, as you say, you opened pretty much immediately into several others. We've covered the Spitfire on extended, so I'm going to skip over that just for the moment. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Flight Sim Center, because that really was a step into something different.
Absolutely. It had been in the back of my mind, well, as a child. I'll tell you where it all started. When I was 13 years old, I went with the aircraft to RAF Kinloss, and we had to go. I had 3 flights booked in the Nimrod. They all got cancelled because of engine problems, flap problems, and not every flight got cancelled. So is there a bit of a, well, we'll keep you happy kind of attitude, we'll get you going the simulator. And I flew, very old-fashioned, antiquated, but nonetheless full-size motion Nimrod simulator. And that was amazing. And then things like the Krypton Factor came along, and they were all flying these 737 airliners in the Heathrow, and wow, I'd love to do that, you know. And there's always been something there in the back of my head, and yes, I'm flying Hunters and whatever else, but you still kind of want to fly a bit of big heavy metal somewhere along the line as a pilot. And it had been in my head for a while, if I could get myself a simulator and I could do this, or print the garage.
As one does.
And, yeah, as one does, you know, have a little bit of fun doing that and thinking like that. But never really thinking what would happen. And certainly at the time, it was very complicated to get a full-size simulator. Indeed, it was only British Airways multi-million pound setups, this kind of thing. Yeah. But as technology has progressed, I said, oh, you know, this might be possible. A lot of money still, but might be possible. So I looked into a bit more, and sure enough, I thought, yeah, this might be doable. So I might be living the dream here. And, of course, looked a bit more, found a couple for sale, very expensive bits of kit, a complex machinery to maintain. Man, that's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to take a little bit of convincing for the wife here, you know. And but then it started to dawn on me, there was nothing like this. Obviously, did a bit of research and found one or two other ones down south in this kind of area. And You're lucky down south, you've got all these kind of things. There's nothing like this in the Northeast. I wonder if we can do things to inspire kids and a bit of STEM work and this kind of, and that's how it all started. And then we did a bit of digging, found an empty unit, found a simulator, all within a couple of months. It all came together. Next thing you know, I'm driving a big translucent van back with a full-size 737 cockpit in the back with billions of wires. Not a clue how it's going to work or put it together, or the software or the computers or the projectors or the visual screens, how they're all going to warp together. Didn't have a clue. But naively, as you do when you buy a full-size Spitfire or Vampire, you just plod on through with the whole thing. And about 4 months later, we had a full-size, fully working, and I have to say, impressive looking 737.
It really, really is. Very impressive.
Living the dream, and now we're passing that dream on to others as well.
Yeah, it's. I know several people who have been there. They've absolutely loved the experience. If you're in the north of England, I will put this out there. This is not an expensive flight sim activity. It's very reasonably priced, so do look them up. One question before I ask you about the next stage in your one of the next stages in your journey. How did you go about, I don't know what the right word is it qualified, how did you learn to fly a 737?
The short answer, well, obviously I've got quite a lot of experience flying jets anyway. But the short answer is just self-taught via YouTube videos and official 77 handbooks and aircraft manuals and documents, which is very, very, very in-depth, and just learned it as I went along. We've got a lot of, there's a nice Northeast flight sim group. There's a lot of guys who know the stuff. And of course, I knew a lot of commercial pilots anyway. So when you just combine the whole lot together, and well, what do you do when you fly? Well, how do you do it? You know, you just put it all together, and eventually you get a little bit off everybody, and it just comes. And then obviously it's second nature now. I'm quite happy to fly a 737 for real. I've got the opportunity, but yeah, it's just self-taught, really.
Wow. Okay. So you then had another blinding light, and you went out and bought a Cherokee 6, beautiful aircraft, Piper 32, six-seater, is it?
The one we've gone for is a seven-seater.
Seven-seater.
It was originally built as a six-seater, yes, but we've got a little jump seat in between, so we've got seven seats in ours.
Right, and you've you don't just use it for your own pleasure, although we'll come to that in a minute. You've started Blue Yonder Air Tours.
That's right. The European aviation side of things, we also, they changed a lot of regulations back in 2012, relaxed a few of the rules. And then, thankfully, the CAA followed on with them rules as well. And that allows us basically to do effectively pleasure flights, introductory training flights, cost-sharing flights, and spread the joy, you know, pass it on to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we can now take up to six people, seven people flying in the aircraft. anywhere around the, technically anywhere in the country or Europe they may want to fly to, or just a little 20-minute jolly, just have a bit of an experience, and then hopefully they'll then go on to learn to fly or get more interested in aviation and become air traffic control or just something, just to, you know, hopefully inspire them to do like a little bit more in aviation and see the house from above or whatever they want to do, basically, or just see the Newcastle Tyne Bridges. But yeah, again, it's like all the little things I've done, it's just, you know, something different. It inspires people, hopefully. It gets the people who are scared of flying to come along, you know, because at the minute we're running a separate course where in the Boeing 777 at the Flight Sim Center, we'll do a fear of flying course, which when once that's completed, we can then move on to the real aircraft and they can have a go of the real thing. What they've understood and learned in the simulator can now be put forward into real life.
Wonderful. Now, you've had a pretty interesting summer. I've been following you on social media. You've been to visit my wife's island. You've been down to Jersey. But you've just returned from Paris as well, haven't you? What is it like to fly a general aviation aircraft around the country and across into Europe?
Well, the short answer, it's fantastic. It's absolute freedom is the first thing. And just the sights that you see are stunning. I mean, we can do anything we like. We're not stuck to commercial routes. We did all of the Normandy beach landings all the way from Utah all the way to Golden Sword Beach. We flew over Pegasus Bridge, which is a famous bridge from the Normandy D-Day landings. We then flew all around Paris. We've seen the Eiffel Tower. We've seen the Palace of Versailles. We've seen loads of World War II war graves and World War I trenches, memorials, bomb craters. You know, you name it, we've seen it. It's just unbelievable what you can see, and you're not stuck to the timetable of what goes on at the airport. I'll go when I want to go, when we're ready to go, and you just see the whole lot. It's just total freedom, and you just do it at your own pace.
It's certainly, you know, the term living the dream, it certainly looked like a wonderful summer for you and flying. But you've also been flying into air shows as well. What a fantastic way to go and see an air show.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that we are promoting as well now. And indeed, we're going to the Duxford Battle of Britain show in September. So obviously, not only can we just do local flights and sightseeing pleasure flights, we can do cost-sharing flights to an air show. So if somebody wants to say, look, you know, I'm sick of the traffic and it takes forever to get down there, we can, you know, an hour and a half, 1 hour, 15 minutes, and I got down to Duxford from our base into Duxford, chauffeur driven around either side of the airfield, you've beaten all the queues, you've got in early, you've got a good spot, you're there all day, and we are literally back home before most people have even left the airfield at the end of that air show. But just to fly into somewhere like Duxford, and literally the first time I went this year in the Cherokee 6 when we got it, we went straight to Duxford just for a day trip, and we were literally taxiing with the Blenheim and two Spitfires. Unbelievable, you know, just to hear these. I mean, literally, I could see John Romaine out my left wingtip right next to me, both doing power checks at the same time.
Wow.
Stunning.
Wow. Neil, where can we find out about you? Where can we follow you online, learn about the Flight Sim Center and also about Blue Yonder?
Well, obviously, Blue Yonder is www.airtours.com. That tells you all about our website, us, the aircraft, what we can do. We've also got a Facebook page, Blue Yonder Air Tours, and the Flight Sim Center is www.flightsimcenter.com. And again, Flight Sim Center on Facebook page, and you can see all about what we do, how we get on there, all the other fighter jet simulators, what's coming in the future, motion simulators, better software, better graphics, more virtual reality side of things to do with the simulators, and perhaps another aircraft joining the fleet in the next 3 to 4 months, you were saying. We'll see where that one goes.
Okay. Now, I have to ask this question. Not sure if your wife's listening now or whether she's listening to this when we go to air, but what's Neil's next project?
Well, the next project is the second aircraft, hopefully, and that's going to be De Havilland Tiger Moth. So we're going to start doing Tiger Moth flights.
Wow.
Which I know you've got a little bit of experience in yourself. So
I've got 30 minutes, 40 minutes in my logbook, So, yes, you can call on me at any time, Neil. I will drive the 250 miles out to you. Interestingly enough, though, just talking about that, I found the Tiger Moth quite hard to fly, actually. I didn't find it that easy. It wasn't unstable, but it was very, very light.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the only downside with a Tiger Moth is that it has the lower wing's very low to the ground. It's very long wing, and it's got a high center of gravity. It's all wrong, really, and it's very easy to tip over and ground loop and that kind of thing. And its crosswind component's terrible. The ailerons don't really work, and therefore you've got a huge rudder, but of course that's not particularly great on a crosswind. Yeah. So yes, it's not a particularly fantastic, wonderful plane to fly, but the history, the nostalgia, the open cockpit, absolutely, the aerobatics, yeah, there's just nothing else really. I mean, I have looked at other aircraft, stomps and Stiemens, that kind of thing,
yeah,
but they don't really have the same je ne sais quoi, is that the word?
Yeah.
It's the Tiger Moth. A Tiger Moth is a Tiger Moth. Everybody knows it. It ticks all the boxes. It's great fun. On a nice day, you kind of beat it, really.
Neil, thanks so much for joining us, and we're going to get you back on sometime to hear about how the Tiger Moth's going.
What's next? Okay, no problem at all.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, Neil.
Many thanks. Thanks now. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that, Peter. Now, the final two interviews from the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In. First, Micah talks with Tim Bickford about his restored Travelair 4000.
We're talking with Tim Bickford, who flew in today in a gorgeous biplane. It's a Travelair. Tim, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Travelair and your history with this particular aircraft?
Sure. It's a 1928 Travelair 4000. It actually left the factory as a 2000 with an OX5 engine and was converted later in 1932 with a Wright J5, which made it a Travelair 4000, which is the current designation for the aircraft. I've had it for 25 years, although it arrived to me in crates, and by crates I mean baskets. It last flew as a crop duster in the 50s, and over a course of 19 years... a very slow but methodical restoration. It stands here today. Finished about 6 years ago.
Well, how did you come across it some 20 years ago?
I'm a woodworker by trade, and I wanted a wooden airplane to work on. I've always flown. I've flown since I was 18. And it was very, very small ad in Trade-A-Plane back when, you know, it was just Trade-A-Plane. There was nothing else, no internet to speak of. And it was a project in a guy's garage who used to fly for American Airlines, who came down with Alzheimer's, and his family was selling the aircraft. And I saw the ad, responded to it, drove out to Naperville, Illinois, rented a U-Haul, rented a U-Haul and brought it back.
And so it was in crates. So you put it together on your own?
Absolutely. I spent 2 years doing research. I petitioned the FAA through the Freedom of Information Act to get original certification drawings. Was able to acquire those in a microfilm format, had those printed up. So I had documentation to make parts that were missing, scrounged, and over years made a lot of contacts. They're fairly easy airplanes to work on as far as they go. If you just look at one piece at a time, it's a big project when you look at everything, but if you break it down to a single part, it's fairly simple.
Now, obviously, you've been flying for quite some time. You've flown a lot of other aircraft. How does she handle? How does it feel?
You know, it's the proverbial flies like a J3 Cub. It really does. It doesn't have any bad tendencies. The visibility's not so good on when you roll out on final, but none of them were back then. And, you know, in the grass, she's a sweetheart, and on the pavement, it's not bad at all either.
Was she your first open cockpit, or you had open cockpit experience prior?
First one I've owned. I've flown several, yeah, I mean, first one I've owned. The open cockpit things, it's nice. It's, you know, it's a breeze in your hair. It's it can beat you up a little bit on long flights. It's a constant, you know, buffeting. But it's, you know, we're only doing 85 miles an hour at best anyway in the thing, so it's not too bad.
I had the opportunity to fly open cockpit just one time, and as a passenger, there's no other experience like it when you're going low and slow and just having a wonderful time.
Yeah, it's a rare day if that makes it to 1,000 feet AGL. It's because it's just so fun to stay down low, and you can see what's going on. You can smell the smell, see the sights, and it's just the panoramic's beautiful from the open cockpit.
Now, you're a member of this local EAA 141 group. Where are you based?
In Lymington, Maine, which is where the chapter's headquartered, which is 25 miles due west of here. We're a small group, grassroots aviation. We have a little grass strip and a 3,000-foot paved strip at a privately owned airport, actually, but public, open to the public.
Have you been able to do with the EAA any, or interested in doing any with the EAA, any Young People's Young Eagles flights in the open cockpit? Because I'm sure that kids would just get a real thrill from it.
You know, interestingly enough, I planned on doing I flew Young Eagles. I also have a 170. I flew Young Eagles in that this year, and I planned on the biplane. Excuse me, I'll let some noise die. I planned on the biplane this year, but it was out of annual, and I was waiting on some parts for the brakes, so I couldn't. It wasn't airworthy at the time. So next year for sure.
That's something you definitely have to get some pictures of, and I'd love to hear about it, maybe from you and from one of the Young Eagles that you take flying.
Great. I mean, if you go to our chapter is 141, EA141.org. I'm not sure what the date is for next year's Young Eagles, but if you check that website currently, you'll find a date, and the airplane will be there, and I'll be there.
I'll try to be there too. Tim, thank you so much for joining us here in the Airplane Geeks.
Great. Thanks a lot.
And here's Micah with Jonathan Good, an FAA inspector and fly-in air boss.
We're with Jonathan Good, FAA safety inspector and air boss for the fly-in today. Jonathan, you've been doing this for quite some time, haven't you, as the air boss here at this fly-in?
Yeah, I spent my 16th year doing this. The Phineas and Mary Lou Sprague, who own this farm, have doing this for 26 years. This is my 16th year being the air boss out here. And we've set a new record this year. We have 73 airplanes on a 1,740-foot grass strip.
It's unbelievable that you're being able to control all that space, watching them take off and land, kind of trying to enjoy it at the same time, but keeping your eye out for safety. What's it like trying to keep your eye out for safety as the air boss and the FAA safety inspector?
Well, it helps to be obsessive compulsive, which I think I am, but also keep your head on a swivel, keep the radios going, and coordinate your team. We have the Civil Air Patrol kind enough to help with the parking, people to watch the walking the road, make sure they walk in front of aircrafts who are landing or taxiing. We coordinate this ahead of time best we can, but it's just constant surveillance and communication with our team.
Now, you said you had 73 aircraft come in, which is our record for this, and this has been going on for a little over 20 years, so 73 is a big number. How do you juggle it all in your head? You had mentioned earlier before we started the interview that taking off isn't quite as troubling or difficult as landing and putting them in control. Can you describe the difference a little bit?
Yeah, when you're coming into land, you're in the air and you got to keep moving. So planes on downwind, some on base, some on final, some back taxiing, some trying to get parked. You got to kind of keep them in your head where they are and advise them where their aircraft are. And, of course, as an uncontrolled field, they have the final say if they want to land or take off, but they usually talk to us to make it easier. Taking off is a lot easier because they're taxiing and they take off when the... See, flaps to your friends here. They'll get you off 700 feet quicker. Do a soft field, short field takeoff. Every time, you'll be fine. They take off when the runway is clear, but when you're landing, you have to keep moving in the air, obviously. Either do a 360 on final or slow it down to space yourself with the aircraft taking off ahead of you. This year is even more challenging because we had to back taxi aircraft from the length of the runway to another field at the departure end across a road to park them so the people on landing had to extend their downwinds to make it work right. But we just coordinated and used our radios, and it worked out okay. Cooperation and safety are our watchwords here at Spur when we do this.
Now, in terms of operation and safety, and to discuss it in a way that we can talk about it, have you seen anything today that you would call interesting, and what might have that been, if you're willing to discuss it?
Sure. I had two airplanes who want to make low passes. Low passes are a Federal Aviation Regulation violation. You can't be closer than 500 feet to someone or a group of people or any object unless you're landing or taking off. and no high speeds, of course. So a couple guys who wanted to do it, I said, no low passes here. You had to be at least 500 or 800 feet above the airport to do that, and no acrobatic maneuvers. And this is good because last year we had an acrobatic maneuver by a plane up to a hammerhead, a low-speed pass, several violations violated, and he was convicted and lost his license for 4 months.
It's a good thing that we keep an eye out for those kinds of things, because we want to have good pilots out there and keep the skies safe, because so many people, not listeners to this show, but so many of the general public don't understand the safety involved in flying and don't realize that it's really a very safe sport and you're safer in the air than you are on the ground.
Yes, and it's really important that we keep people acting in a safe manner, because pilots, like anybody else, if they try some maneuver that looks cute, some will say, I can do something better, or I can do something better. Pretty soon we've got a smoking hole in the ground, an accident, and we don't want that. We want this a safe operation. We want people to come here and have fun and enjoy the sound, just fall, and enjoy themselves. Just follow the maneuvers, follow the rules of the FARs in good sense, and you'll be fine.
John, thank you so much for spending some time with us here at the Airplane Geek.
Thanks.
Thank you, Micah. As we've said, we love it when you send us your own recordings about your aviation experiences. Last episode, Launchpad Marzari encouraged you to do that, and now he provides an example, telling us about his favorite flight.
I was flying from Germany to Switzerland to pick up a friend who was working in Zurich. I was in a Piper PA-28. Now, the Swiss take their neutrality very serious, so even though I was VFR, I was on a flight plan. So I checked in with Swiss Air Control, having crossed into Swiss airspace at the Schaffhausen VOR within 2 minutes of my projected time, I might add. At which time their controller said to me, November 4306 Whiskey, please divert to Zurich International. This was not on my flight plan and not what I wanted to do. With less than 80 hours in my logbook, Zurich International is an airport I did not want to go to and had not filed for. I replied that I had a flight plan for Burfeld to clear customs. Who knew what the landing fees at Zurich International would run? They again requested I come to Zurich International. I again told them I had a flight plan and a customs appointment to clear customs at Burfeld. The ATC then informed me, Hans is sick and didn't come in today, so you're going to have to clear customs here in Zurich. Okay, that plan didn't work. Thinking quickly, I went for the last-ditch effort and said, I don't have a landing clearance slot for Zurich. To which the ATC controller said, prepare to copy. So, with my VFR approach plates for Switzerland, my landing clearance slot, I was vectored onto runway 16, did a great landing. It's hard not to do a great landing when you have 12,000 feet of runway, and was given my first ever progressive taxi instructions. I got lost. They had to send the follow me truck for me. Administrative note, Zurich doesn't have an executive airport. Only an executive / general aviation are handled out of Concourse Echo at their regular airport. After being marshaled into a parking spot, the customs agent in his golf cart came out and asked me if I had anything to clear. No. He laughed, looked inside my little airplane, then graciously offered me a ride to the terminal. I was the only aircraft in a sea of executive aircraft that had a propeller on the front. I called my friend and told him to take a cab to Zurich International. In the pilot's lounge, the BizJet pilots were more than courteous, allowing me to use their logons to file my exit flight plan. They were amused and quite impressed that I had an unlimited clearance slot and an open-ended takeoff slot number. Because I had a landing slot number already assigned to me, total fees were only $38.35. My friend got a ride to the airport from his boss and was totally impressed and suspicious, because all he could see was executive jets. My friend got out of the car to leave the country. His boss, seeing nothing but multi-million-dollar biz jets, leaned over and said, I'm freezing all your accounts. Did I mention my friend worked at United Bank of Switzerland? Pre-flight, engine start, request a taxi, and was told to join the conga line, be sequenced for takeoff based on my slot number.
I was number 9 in line. There was a 747 in front of me and a Lockheed L-1011 behind me. I could see all the way to the front of the line looking under everybody's fuselage. When I was about number 5 in line, the tower called me up and asked if I would accept a midfield takeoff. Well, half of 12,000 feet is 6,000 feet, which is 2,000 feet more than the longest runway I had ever used up until today. So I said, yes, I would. I was told an immediate left, you are cleared for takeoff on runway 16, November 4306 Whiskey. Please expedite. Okay. I was about 300 feet and still over the runway when the tower told me to take an immediate right-hand turn to 270. So at a height of between 400 and 1,000 feet as we climbed up, we were vectored over beautiful downtown Zurich. They really wanted me out of their airspace. We flew out of the snow-covered Alps. For one brief shining moment, Marzari Airlines, with limited service to Switzerland, had the one thing Lufthansa, United, Swiss Air crave, and that was a priority customs clearance, unlimited landing slot with expedited handling to Zurich International. Even Richard Branson was envious of us that day. This is your Airplane Geeks reporter at large, frequency change approved. Good day.
Finally, we received an email from a 14-year-old student pilot in Australia. Solomon is truly passionate about flying, and I was able to speak with him for a few minutes. Here it is. Well, I'm very pleased to be speaking with an Australian student pilot, a fairly young one, one of our younger listeners, I think. Solomon is just 14. Solomon, it's great to be talking with you. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks very much, Max. It's great to be on the podcast and really looking forward to talking to you.
Now, you're a student pilot at this point. How much flight instruction have you received so far?
At this moment in time, I've received 28.2 hours of instruction.
And what have you been flying?
A Technam P92, and then I've just moved on to the Technam P2AA.
How about your flight instructor? How did you select your flight instructor, or was it based on location or the airplane? What brought you to this particular instructor with this particular airplane?
Oh, well, I've had a couple of instructors over the time. Both have been very good instructors. The reason I had to move across to my second instructor was because my first instructor went overseas for a little bit. I met her at the club when I came out to get some information on a trial flight back in 2015 or 16, a while ago. That was when I was 11 years old. And she was actually an explorer. She was the first female Australian woman to walk all four ice caps.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty exciting. That's a kind of a unique accomplishment. So you're flying through a flying club? Are you a member of a flying club?
Yep, member of a flying club. It's an awesome flying club. A lot of people there, which really support me to get to my goal of being a pilot.
And so why did you start this adventure? What kind of sparked your interest at the beginning?
I think my interest was really sparked before I was born, really. My father was a pilot when I was just a little kid. I can't really remember flying with him much. I did about 5 flights with him as a kid, but he stopped flying when I was 3 years old, disappointingly. So that really cut it off. But I loved aviation growing up. I used to have this book with me all the time. It was on World War II aircraft, and I never read it. I just looked at the pictures because I was a little young to read it. But that was really how I started off in aviation.
And do your friends know about your interest?
Yeah, they do. I can't say they take much interest in it, but I'm sure when I get my certificate, they might take a bit more interest in it.
Well, sure, especially if it gives them the opportunity to go flying with you. Maybe that'll spark their interest. Maybe they'll even start to think about learning to fly themselves.
Yeah, sure. That's something I really look forward to introducing more people into aviation, because at this moment in time, aviation doesn't have so many young pilots. And that's something I really want to encourage young kids to get into.
Yeah, that's really wonderful, Solomon, because it's something I think you know that we talk about fairly frequently is in order to have a good, strong pilot population, you need to feed the pipeline, right? You need to introduce young folks to flying and get them interested. So, yeah, you did express that as something that you'd like to work towards. You did that when you wrote to us at Airplane Geeks. Do you have any ideas about how you might go about getting young folks interested in aviation?
Yeah, at the moment, I'm planning to fly solo around Australia and talk to kids about becoming a pilot and achieving their dreams. But at the moment, that trip, it's under works, but who knows, might get there, might not.
Yeah, that's a great approach. Show by example. Show them what is possible for a young person to accomplish, and maybe they'll be inspired as well. How about your parents, Solomon? Are they supportive of you?
Yeah, they are. They've been really good. As I told you, my dad stopped flying when I was really young, but since I've started flying, he's got back into it, yeah. which is awesome to fly with him again. We may even be flying off to somewhere today. It's spring today and weather's pretty good out there. And my mother, she is pretty frightened of flying, but she's been very supportive as well. And one of my major goals is to make her like flying.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I think that's an interesting point, an important point that particularly for a young person, if they have the support of their parents, that's going to be very helpful. If they're against the whole idea, you know, the other extreme, then, wow, that makes it much more difficult. So it's great to hear that, you know, your parents are supportive.
Yeah, it really is good to have them supporting me. It wouldn't be as easy as it has been if my parents didn't support me the way they have.
Now, what about what's coming up? You're going to be reaching your next birthday, 15, pretty quickly here, aren't you?
Yeah, that's very exciting. My 15th is coming up in 8 days, and that'll allow me up to my first solo. And because I've got quite a few hours, I'll be able to get my pilot certificate after that pretty shortly.
So are you nervous about the solo, or are you fairly confident?
I'm fairly confident about the solo, but of course there are quite a lot of nerves that go along with that.
Sure, and that's understandable, I think. I think if you weren't at least a little bit nervous, then maybe you're not, you know, you wouldn't be thinking about it as hard as you perhaps should. But as you've been taking lessons and learning to fly, what part of it did you find most challenging?
Most challenging, that's a hard one. I think all of flying it's hard to learn at the start. I think in the circuit was the time I've spent most on at the moment. So yeah, landing the aircraft is quite a challenge. Mm-hmm. And remembering procedures is also something that I've tried to get in me quite well, because that's important, obviously, when you're in the circuit and on the ground. I think there has been a couple of times that I've made mistakes, which weren't too major, but it's really important not to kick yourself over that mistake, because if you fixate on that, then that's really going to impact you in the circuit and on the ground.
Yes, a mistake can be a good opportunity to learn a lesson, obviously. So if you don't make mistakes, at least some mistakes, I think maybe you don't learn as much as you would otherwise. Tell us a little bit about the flying club. How many members and what kinds of folks? Are you the youngest person in the flying club?
Ooh, I think actively flying, I might be. There are quite a few young kids there as well at the aerodrome. We have a few flying schools at my aerodrome, which is really good. But the club members are just fantastic. I'm really privileged to get to know a lot of them. I've been flying with quite a few of them, and it's just the community there is just one of the most amazing communities. Just the other day, me and my father got back from a flight, and one of the members I know walked up to my father and said he'd like to donate an hour's worth of lessons to me. which was really, it was something I was very proud of. I have the privilege of that community supporting me. It's just a fantastic community. And there's so many people in aviation who support young kids like me.
Yeah, that's just wonderful. If you have the support, if the flying club, if the community is welcoming, then that certainly makes it a lot easier and a lot more fun. And just, you know, you get into the whole social aspect. Does your club have any events through the course of the year?
Oh, they have a few open days and so forth that it try to get other people involved. But they used to do events there, but they don't do that anymore. So, no, not much anymore.
And I think that when you wrote to us, back to your plan to fly around Australia someday, were you going to make that a charity flight as well as an opportunity for young folks to get interested in flying?
Yeah, that's right. I was looking to make that a charity flight for the Royal Flying Doctors. That's currently in the works. We're trying to organise something, but that high-risk plan, so the Royal Flying Doctors might not endorse me on that.
Well, we'll see how that goes. You'll have to keep us informed and let us know how that works out, and well, and also how your solo goes. We want to hear about that.
Sure thing. That I'm really looking forward to doing that, and that'll be really good to get. I'm really looking forward to talking to people about that.
I think that is important, and you're to be congratulated for, you know, thinking about it in those terms. That's really, really impressive. And of course, there's lots of ways to talk about it. Standing in front of an airplane is, you know, you're on a tour, of course, is one way, but online or even through podcasts, this one or others, lots of ways to reach people out there. So we look forward to seeing you show up in lots of different places. But how's general aviation in Australia these days? Are there any big issues going on that have you and the other members of your club talking?
General aviation in Australia at the moment is on a downhill at the moment because we have the light sport aircraft that have come in. And so there is a branch under CASA called RAOS, which is now, they register pilots, and they're a bit different from general aviation because of their light sport aircraft, but they're still in general aviation. Mm-hmm. So the license I'm going for, the RAOS, is it doesn't require as much training as the PPL, the private pilot license, which allows you to fly large aircraft. And that PPL is sort of in a bit of a strife at the moment. Not many people can afford to get into that when there's obviously something there that's a lot cheaper.
Sure, and that's understandable. All right. Well, Solomon, we want to thank you for this chat, just a brief chat at this point. But again, we look forward to following you as you progress. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell the Airplane Geeks audience while we have you here on Skype?
Well, if there was more younger listeners, I would encourage them to get out there. But if there's any fathers or parents out there who have young kids who might not be into aviation yet, I really encourage them to give them a nudge, see if they would like to do that. Give them a trial flight. Always a good one. Trial flights are usually discounted. And that's a really good way to get into aviation.
Great advice. Thanks, Solomon. Really appreciate it. Do you have any online presence or anything that you'd want to pass along, or links to any particular sites or anything like that?
Oh, not at the moment, Max. In the future, there'll definitely be plenty of links. So maybe in the future, I'll send you those across and we can also organize something from there.
Very good. Solomon, again, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Max. Appreciate it.
For some time, I've wanted to sponsor an Airplane Geeks Junior podcast. Everything by young aviation enthusiasts. They would create and record all the content. In fact, I even registered at airplanegeeksjunior.com, but it's kind of a dormant idea, at least for now. Well, Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next time, we'll return to our usual format with aviation news from the past week, a great guest, and more. Don't forget to visit the aviation events calendar at avgeekfests.com and load in some of the events in your area that would be of interest to other avgeeks. And feel free to share the avgeekfests.com link across your network. Also, please help promote the Airplane Geeks podcast wherever you can, on social media, at work, at your flying club, wherever. We'd be very grateful. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/519. Now, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts on iOS, in Google Podcasts on Android, or through the podcast app you use on your mobile device. If you'd like to go old-fashioned and want an email whenever a new episode is published, there's a very easy way to do that. Just visit subscribebyemail.com and type in Airplane Geeks. With each episode, you'll receive an email that includes an embedded audio player. And actually, you can use subscribebyemail.com for any podcast. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his music compositions where he incorporates aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody. We'll be right back.